is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and thank you to Shano and Danielle for filling in for me on Friday while I was up in Minneapolis. Had a great time at the Blue State Ball. Lots and lots of people showed up. And Stephanie Miller was there, and my only regret was I didn't run into her. I missed her. I was looking forward to saying hi. But anyway, we had a great time. I had a great time. I was there alone. And, life goes on. So here in Washington, D.C., we've got this strange guy in town. And, back in 2002, he came to the United States and he spoke before Congress. And he said, and I quote, "If you take out Saddam's regime, I guarantee you that it will have enormous positive reverberations in the region." Bibi Netanyahu, 2002, speaking before the United States House of Representatives, United States Congress, as a private citizen. "If you take out Saddam's regime, I guarantee you that it will have an enormous positive reverberations on the region." Right, so we took out Saddam's regime and replaced it with a largely Shia regime, which caused all the Sunnis who were, the army was almost entirely Sunni because, Saddam had organized things that way. You had to be a Ba'ath Party member, blah, 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 blah. And so the Sunnis then developed this like kind of underground network and started fighting back. And a good chunk, probably in the country of Iraq, probably 70-80% of the people who call themselves Islamic State or ISIS or ISIL or whatever, are the old Iraqi army. So it's sort of like, you want to hear Netanyahu's speech? Just go back to 2002 and listen to any of George Bush's speeches. It's the same guy. Bibi Netanyahu, George W. Bush, neocons, right-wingers, people who believe that war solves problems. This, to me, this is just astonishing that the Prime Minister of Israel would take an American Republican political operative who was the protege of Frank Luntz and have him renounce his American citizenship, so his citizenship is exclusively Israeli, and then become the Israeli ambassador to the United States, Ron Dermer, I believe his name is, and then have his ambassador negotiate with the Republican Speaker of the House without informing the president, without informing anybody, to come and make another sales pitch to Congress. For what? One thing that I find fascinating, this is an Israeli news agency this morning. I have this via Victoria Jones from the Talk Radio News Service in her daily newsletter to the press. She writes, "An Israeli news agency has cited a Kuwaiti newspaper report claiming that President Obama thwarted an Israeli military attack against Iran's nuclear facilities in 2014, last year, by threatening to shoot down Israeli jets before they could reach their targets in Iran. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is reportedly forced to abort the planned Iraq attack." The Israeli news agency is the Israel National News. You like neocons? Apparently you like Bibi and you like John. And frankly, it's not Iran here's my little editorial opinion piece. Netanyahu is not here, as far as I can tell. I mean, time may prove that I'm wrong. But Netanyahu is not here to say we have to do something to or about Iran. Now, keep in mind, Iran has signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Agreement. They are enriching uranium, but only to the level necessary for their nuclear power plants, which they want to have as a member of the modern world. Keep in mind, Barack Obama just went over to India, and what kind of a deal did he work out with President Modi? Hey, have some nuclear power plants. That's what we do. We've got very, very large corporations that make large political contributions to both parties. So our politicians go overseas. What do? They sell nuclear power plants. Iran has one. Everybody has one, it seems. It's a stupid way to make electricity, but what can you say? But Netanyahu is not, to the best of my knowledge, I mean, we'll find out tomorrow, I suppose, when he speaks before Congress. He spoke this morning before AIPAC. To the best of my knowledge, he's not here to say, let's blow up Iran's nuclear facilities, as apparently he tried to do last year and Obama stopped him. This is not about that. At least as far as we can tell. It is not about, hey, United States, would you join me in doing this? No, apparently all it is he doesn't want us having to deal with Iran. It's coming across, it seems, at least to me, it seems like what's really going on here, what he's really saying is we don't want you to have a relationship with this country, with Iran, this country that we view as a competitor slash enemy in the region. In fact, what he said, I mean, this is the exact quote he said earlier this morning, we are strongly opposed to the agreement being formulated between the world powers and Iran that could endanger Israel's very existence. Yeah, it's not going to endanger Israel's very existence. Israel, by the way, has lots and lots of nuclear weapons. And I really don't think that even the craziest of the Ayatollahs are suicidal. And they have issued a fatwa, you know, a religious ruling, saying that nuclear weapons are a violation of Islam, that Iran would never build nuclear weapons. And so far, it looks like they're keeping to that. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. A group inside Israel, former commanders of the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, their army, Mossad, their intelligence, their equivalent of the CIA, Shin Bet, and the Israeli police blast Netanyahu for his speech to Congress. This is what Major General Amnon Reshef. And by the way, why aren't we hearing all the things that I just shared with you? Why aren't we seeing this on our television? Major General Amnon Reshef, former head of the Israeli Army's Armored Corps, on behalf of 200 top Israeli generals and top security officials, said, and I quote, when the Israeli prime minister argues that his speech will stop Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons, he is not only misleading Israel, he is strengthening Iran. 200 retired Israeli generals and top security officials. A lot of people in Israel very embarrassed today by their prime minister and our Republican Speaker of the House and Frank Luntz, you know, by what's going on here. Okay, enough of that. I got my rant out. I said what I wanted to say. From there, I want to go to suicide, the economy, this judge that has said he's going to protect the Koch donors. Koch brothers, you know, Forbes just came out with, it was a Forbes or Fortune? Forbes just came out with their richest people, and it looks like the Koch brothers each made a little short of $3 billion last year. That's like money in the bank, take home, leftover, profit, whatever you want to call it. If you made $3 billion, well, between the two of them, $6 billion. If you made $6 billion last year, what would you do with that money?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Let's see. According to the Supreme Court, you could take $1 billion of it and buy yourself a president. You think they'll try? Oh, they are? Really? 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Free Speech TV, by the way, is in their fund drive this week. You'll hear the pitch for it at the bottom of the hour, as it were. So just a heads up and get ready. 877-378-8669 is the telephone number. And if you're listening on one of our radio stations, if they're doing a pledge drive this week, please pitch in with them too. Tony, watching Free Speech TV in Aubrey, California. Hey, Tony, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being there and speaking to these issues. You know, you mentioned that that you're I think you said astonished about the Netanyahu, and I'm not. I'm completely frustrated and just fed up with this country, the world, and where it's going. This oligarchy, and it seems the Russians, the United States, England, Israel are all in this let's grab as much money as we can and suppress us whoever we want, and it's day-to-day living is just ridiculous these days. Our gas prices went up. It was down to where I'm in California. It was down to 2.25 the last month or last 3 weeks. It went up to about to almost $3 again, and it's about $15 or $20 out of my pocket every week. And I can barely afford that. That's a hit on my budget.
Wow.
I was doing very well, you know, in a business and whatever, and of course just the economy and different things in this whole. Corporate takeover of everything has just drained everything and everyone. It's just so I'm not astonished at all. I'm just I don't know. I applaud you. I would really like to see this message get out. It's too bad. I talk to people and I as much as I can, but it's tough.
Yeah, it is. Tony, thank you for calling and sharing your story with us. I wish you the very best. We've got to come up with a better way to run a country. David in Phoenix. Hey, David.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Well, I just wanted to kind of let people know what's going on here in Phoenix anyway. And there's three factual bits of information about Arizona that make it different than other red states, like we've got more democracy or almost. We have more independents than we have Republicans this day, about 36% independents, 34% Republicans, and about 30% Democrats. And also we have many elections in the state, which are funded by the state. However, it's been greatly weakened with a U.S. Supreme Court decision. And now in Arizona, we have a system where a commission draws the legislative boundaries so that we don't have near as much gerrymandering as they do in other states.
Right.
And today, the U.S. Supreme Court is going to make a decision about whether or not the legislature should have that power back.
Right. They're not actually going to make the decision today, David. They're going to hear the arguments today. So you can expect the decision in three to 6 months. But yeah, I'm with you. And this, if the court knocks down the right of a state to basically stop gerrymandering, then not only is Arizona in big trouble, so is California. Thanks a lot, David, for the call. Excellent point. We'll be back. Okay, I want to move on from Bibi, although, you know, if you have calls and you want to talk about it, that's fine, but we'll pick that up at the bottom of the hour. But I wanted to go from Bibi to the state of our economy. Because this, you know, and not just our economy, our body politic as well as our body economic. We are right now, you and I, we are in some ways very fortunate and in some ways very unfortunate to be living in one of those interesting times that the old Chinese curse talked about. We are living in a country that over the last 30 years, and really 35 years or so, since the presidency of Ronald Reagan, has become a different country. We are a different country today than we were 35 years ago. I mean, you know, quite literally, we have a different political system. You have a situation where 5 million more Democrats than Republicans run, you know, get votes for the Democratic Party, for the House of Representatives, and yet the Republicans control the House. 20 million more Democrats than Republicans over the last couple of elections in the Senate voted for Democratic senators rather than Republican senators, and yet you have Republican control of the Senate. You've got states where Republicans are taking over states like Scott Walker in Wisconsin, Bozo in Michigan, down in Florida. But in Wisconsin in particular, it would not have happened if it weren't for out-of-state money. Big out-of-state money. Koch brothers out of state money. And now this judge has said, and by the way, I asked the question, what would you do if you'd earned $6 billion, $5.5 billion last year? Hey, you take the first, $100 million, one-tenth of a billion? You take the first $100 million and say, okay, this is my living expenses for the year. Buy a $20 million mansion someplace, buy a private jet for another $10, $20 million, the cost of the jet and the cost of maintaining it for a couple of years. Buy a villa in Sardinia. You're up to $30 million. I mean, how long does it take to spend $100 million? How many restaurant meals is that? That's like, stretch around the world, stack them up to the moon kind of thing. That's just $100 million. If these two guys made $6 billion last year, that's $1 billion every other month. That's $500 million a month. That's $125 million a week. That's something like a little short of $20 million a day. Now, working an 8-hour day, that's roughly $3 million an hour, if I'm still doing my math right. And I might not be. I'm not particularly good with math in my head, but it seems like I'm following the line here. So you're making $3 million an hour. What do you do with that money? When is enough enough? Well, what the Kochs are doing is they're changing America. I mean, they genuinely believe that the political system of this country, particularly the political system post-New Deal, post-Franklin Roosevelt, is bad. They think, this country, our government is out of control. It's spending too much money. It's helping poor people. So they created these groups where people can make donations and keep themselves anonymous. Because they're trying to raise almost $1 billion to put Scott Walker in the White House, among other things. The Americans for Prosperity Foundation, a nonprofit. This is Susie Madrick writing in Crooks and Liars. The Americans for Prosperity Foundation, a nonprofit foundation started by the brothers, persuaded the judge on Tuesday to block California Attorney General Kamala Harris's demand for the names and addresses of its donors. So a Secretary of State cannot find out who is spending money in their state or for what or where it came from. Now, meanwhile, suicides are exploding. Koch brothers doing great, along with the rest of the top 1%. But suicides exploding. Yay Smith writing over at Naked Capitalism blog. It was picked up also by truthout.org. This from a science website, the Science magazine. Suicide rates for adults between 40 and 64 years of age in the U.S. have risen 40% since 1999. This is from the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. External economic factors were present in 38%, rough 37.5% of all completed suicides in 2010, rising from 32.9% in 2005. Number of suicides using suffocation increased 59%. This is really interesting. I didn't realize this. Relative to other age groups, a larger and increasing proportion of middle-aged suicides have circumstances associated with job, financial, or legal distress and are completed using suffocation. I didn't realize that people who are like just wiped out financially. The same thing in Greece. Reported suicides have doubled in Greece over the last 6 years.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Now, why is this? Why this increase in suicides here in the United States? Because we are becoming the country and the world that the Koch brothers want. More on that after the break. Taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. So happy to have you with us. Okay, 9 months on, Koch's fears realized. I mean, you know, we live in Kokistan, right? We no longer live in the United States of America. We now live in Kokistan. The Koch brothers decide who our, you know, who our politicians are going to be through Americans for Prosperity and the Tea Party and everything else that they fund. They decide what our policy decisions are going to be through the think tanks that they fund. They use their PR arms to make sure that all those people and all those ideas get on television and on radio every single day in the newspapers and the op-ed pages. Why don't we just rename the country? I mean, the Supreme Court has said billionaires can do whatever they damn well please. Let's just rename the country, Kokistan. I mean, it, you know, with the Istan part, it sort of sounds like a third world country, which is the direction we're heading. Right? When Ronald Reagan said government is not the solution to your problems, government is the problem. Spitting in the face of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. This is the new world. With a few exceptions, like Seattle or SeaTac, Washington, just outside Seattle. SeaTac put into place a $15 minimum wage. Bang. No phase in. No, it's going to be, you know, 6 years from now, it'll be $15. We're going to have rent. Nothing. Starting, you know, right away, 9 months ago. So here we are, 9 months later. Now, at the time, a guy named Scott Ostrander, for example, who owned a business in SeaTac, he said, "I am shaking here tonight because I'm going to be forced to lay people off." His business was the Cedarbrook Lodge Hotel. "I am shaking here tonight because of this $15 minimum wage, $15 an hour minimum wage, because I am going to be forced to lay people off. I'm going to take away their livelihood. That hurts. It really, really hurts. And what I am going to have to do on January 1st is eliminate jobs, reduce hours, and as soon as hours are reduced, benefits are reduced." This is what he predicted. 9 months later, Cedarbrook Lodge Hotel is expanding, adding 63 more beds to meet demand. He's hiring people at $15 an hour. Tom Douglas, guy who runs 15 restaurants in the Seattle area, he said, "Higher minimum wage, I'm going to have to shut down a quarter of my restaurants." The voters said, "Tough luck, $15 is a living wage." And Tom Douglas now is opening 5 new restaurants to meet the demand. Now, I realize that there are a lot of you who believed the, maybe or a few of you, my audience I should give more credit to, a few of you who might have believed the whole Reaganomics fantasy, the Scott Walker fantasy, this Sam Brownback fantasy, the Mitt Romney fantasy, the Republican Party fantasy, that if you cut taxes on billionaires, it'll create jobs. It'll stimulate the economy. Well, it turns out that's not true. You cut taxes on billionaires. Ronald Reagan cut taxes on billionaires, you know, first year in office. And what happened? We slumped into the worst recession since the Great Depression. Happened in the second year of Reagan's presidency, right after his tax cuts. Now, shouldn't that tell us something? It took years. It took basically the rest of his presidency to recover from that. And it still hadn't recovered. And it only did because he tripled the national debt to bail out the country from his tax cuts for billionaires. It's really, really simple. When people who spend all their income have a lot of money in their pocket, they make money. They spend that money, and that money stimulates the economy. Paul Buchheit, writing for BuzzFlash, writes a couple of things that we should know. And then I'm going to pick up your phone calls here. He says, for every $1 billion of new stock market wealth, you know how whenever cons go on, you know, like it was Sunday yesterday, so it's time to meet the Republicans. Melissa Harris Perry had Amy Goodman on. That was really sweet. I was impressed. But the big show? No. If we're going to have a Democrat, it's going to be a moderate Democrat. And usually they don't even have Democrats on. But anyhow, for every $1 billion of new stock market, oh, and where I started with this thought was, you know, what they say, whenever they talk about the stock market and Social Security and all this kind of stuff, retirement, the cons will say, oh, you want to mess with the, you want to tax dividends? You've got millions of seniors in the United States who are getting dividend income as part of their retirement. You want to start taxing them? Well, no. See, the tax on capital gains, which is dividend income, which you get from owning stocks, that tax is a progressive tax. If your income is, you know, under $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year, whatever it may be, if you're basically drawing Social Security and a small help from your stock portfolio, you're not going to pay any income tax on that. Or it's going to be very, very little. So here's the number. For every $1 billion of new stock market wealth, most of us average $1 in stock gains. Most of us who are not the Koch brothers, who are not the billionaires, who are not Shelley Adelson. Number two, every year since the recession, the richest 10% have accumulated enough new wealth every year to pay the total cost of Social Security four times over. It's astonishing. And that top 10%, that's people who make $114,000 to $140,000 a year and have at least $600,000 in the bank or in, you know, home equity or whatever it may be. It's 16 million families. They have increased their wealth by $4 trillion every year since 2008. Now, that's the top 10%. Everybody else has increased their wealth? Not at all. Workers paid, and then, right? In the 1950s, workers paid 33 cents in taxes for every dollar corporations paid in taxes. Today, for every 33 cents in taxes that workers pay, corporations, they no longer pay a dollar, which is what they paid during the Eisenhower administration or even the Nixon administration or the Kennedy or Johnson. Corporation no longer pays a dollar when you and I pay 33 cents. Now when you and I pay 33 cents, a corporation pays 7 cents in taxes. Another story that you will not hear on the corporate media because, of course, it's corporations paying the taxes, right? They don't want you to know about that. In fact, Paul Buchheit calculates that basically every year, every household in America is shelling out $10,000 in corporate subsidies. Meanwhile, the average taxpayer in the United States pays about $22 a year in income taxes to cover the cost of food stamps and programs for women and mothers with dependent children or families with dependent children. So why is it that the cons have managed to get all of America so upset about the fact that they're spending $22 a year to support mostly working poor people with food stamps and whatnot? And nobody's upset that we're all spending $10,000 per household per year subsidizing corporate America. See, this is not the United States of America anymore. It's Kokistan. And you know, there's some parts of Kokistan that would like to split off and become Kokmenistan. Right? Texas, the South. We don't want no stinking federal rules. Amazing. Well, anyhow, I got more to my rant, but there's still a little less than two and a half hours to go. So let's pick up some of your phone calls here. Jeff. Hey, Jeff, I'm sorry, I don't have a city for you. Where are you calling from?
Denver, Jeff from Denver.
Oh, hey, Jeff. What's up?
Well, first of all, I think we should end Coke dependency.
There you go. Good one.
Yeah, we don't need to be coke dependent.
Yeah.
Anyway, since you spoke of Israel and Iran, I thought we should contrast our enemies to our allies. So look at the big enemies we've had over the past half century, Iran and Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how many countries have they invaded in the past half century? Well, Iran, none. Cuba, none. They've done some.
Wait a minute, Jeff. Cuba,
yes.
Cuba has invaded a number of countries. They sent something like 300-400 doctors to Liberia. They've sent over 20,000 doctors to different countries in South and Central America to help out. Cuba is aggressively invading other countries with doctors.
Yeah. Exactly, I was going to say that. And if you look at the actual times they've gone to send military action to other countries, it's been to like oppose dictators that the U.S. supported, such as in El Salvador and Nicaragua.
Right.
Now, if you look at the U.S., we overthrew the government in Iran, a democratically elected president in Iran, our enemy, and we support a dictator in Cuba, and we fought on their soil. And then we helped Iraq invade Iran.
That would be Batista, right. And then we helped
Batista, yes. And we overthrew Mossadegh.
Yep.
And then in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Vietnam, Grenada, Panama, Kosovo, all these things, we've had military actions all over the world.
Yep.
Then look at our allies, China. You know, there's the Tibetan territory there.
Yep.
Israel, Palestine, and then Britain, most of the problems in the Midwest, Asia, Mideast, Asia, the South Pacific, etc. Britain has been involved. Our allies have nuclear bombs. They've invaded. Our enemies haven't.
Yeah. Excellent point, Jeff. Excellent point. We need to reevaluate who we are and where we are in the world. Thank you for the call. It's always great to hear from you, Jeff. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So if you were making $1 million an hour, like apparently the Koch brothers do, how would you spend it? We'll be back. Welcome back. Jerry in Spring Lake, North Carolina, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind?
Well, I had a thought the other day. I was wondering why we keep on voting for people that are not good for us because we're told to, and I'm beginning to wonder if maybe we're suffering from battered wife syndrome, a similar syndrome to battered wife or Stockholm syndrome.
I think so. I think very much so. And the problem is that, you know, much like with a battered wife, very often the rest of the family kind of conspire. There's a conspiracy of silence, basically. And we have a conspiracy of silence in our media here in the United States. Nobody is talking about how, you know, average Americans are being beaten up by right-wing billionaires.
Yeah.
I mean, and then you get these articles about how, you know, this billionaire or that billionaire is going to help this politician or that politician. And the article never points out the fact that this was criminal in the United States until just a few years ago, thanks to the Supreme Court. It's amazing. Thank you for the call, Jerry. Excellent point. Bill in Dorset, Ohio. Hey, Bill, what's up? Bill watching Free Speech TV in Dorset, Ohio. Bill is listening to his TV, not his telephone. Michael watching Free Speech TV in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind?
Hey, Mr. Hartman, your question. What would I do if I made $6 billion a year like the Koch brothers?
Right.
First, I'd donate $1,000 to Free Speech TV and have dinner with Luis and yourself.
Sweet.
Then I'd buy you a bigger boat for your ark of animals. Then I'd help every veteran that is in need of help. I would call out Monsanto and pay that all the food has to be marked a GMO product, which I believe is seriously killing us all. And then last, I would ask all the rich people if they consume GMOs. What do you think?
Right. I think that all makes perfect sense. And I don't know all the rich people, but I know a few. And most of the ones I know, even ones who are, quote, conservative, end quote, if they have not enough of a budget to have a household staff, to have a cook on staff, that kind of thing, they always, it's always organic. The food is always organic.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, rich people are no idiots. They know the pesticides are for the little people, you know.
Correct.
So,
thank you, Tom.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. Great to hear from you. Cliff in Claremore, Oklahoma. Got a minute to the break, Cliff. It's all yours.
Okay. First one's a question, and then the second one, different subject, but I'm going to be very quick. Okay. Do you think Netanyahu's speaking before Congress, especially with the Republicans, so then that way the he could make sure that the Republicans can get the Jewish vote in 2016?
Yes.
That's my
question. He's trying to. It may or may not backfire. We'll see.
Right. Okay. And then the second statement is that why is it that so many or it's more like a statement into a question. Why is it that the CEOs are making 300 times more than they did in 1980 when they were making 30 times more and they're isolated from the rest of the population?
Yeah. The simple reason, Cliff, is that they're making more is because Reagan changed the rules of the game. He dropped the top tax rate, so it was easier to take a lot more. He authorized payment of CEOs with stock options rather than with a paycheck. So they pay a capital gains rate rather than a regular, an ordinary income rate. So they have a maximum 15% income tax. I think it's up to 20% now. I could be wrong. And that's why. I mean, you know, basically Reagan just said, hey, let's change the rules of the game so that the CEOs can get really, really rich. And they did, and they did. And it's something that needs to be undone, in my opinion. These salaries are not justified by any objective reality. Thank you, Cliff, for the call. Although it's our new aristocracy. We'll be back. So Michael had an interesting suggestion. He said, you know, if you're making $1 million an hour or $6 billion a year or whatever it is that the Koch brothers make, first thing I'd buy, you know, that I should buy is a bigger boat for an ark for our four animals. Louise and I living in this little boat with three cats and a dog. I never thought of it as an ark. Thank you for that, Michael. Yeah, that's great. Oh, man. By the way, there's a couple other things. One other thing. Let me just get this in quickly, and I'll pick up some more phone calls. Liberal Archie posted this over at Democratic Underground. It's from Gizmodo.com last week. And he writes, I recently met two ex-Army Rangers in a bar and got into the topic of the war against ISIS. They told me they knew the solution. Flip-flops. Seriously, there's this company called Combat Flip-Flops. Matthew Griffin and Donald Lee, they served multiple tours in Afghanistan fighting Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And then they started this company, Combat Flip-Flops. And what they do is they go into countries like Afghanistan or Colombia or Laos, countries that have been torn apart by war, and they build factories and they put women to work making clothes. And this is what they said. Your average fighter just, and not just women, women and men. Your average fighter just wants to make money to feed their families, explains Lee, one of the soldiers. He says, the average annual income for one Afghan is $600. If you give them the option and say, hey, I'll give you $50 to plant this bomb, or I'll give you a job where you can make an honest wage and you don't have to worry about being killed, they'll take the job. It's proven. It works. Yeah, I've been saying that since 2002. You know, we didn't need to go into Afghanistan to get Osama bin Laden. Afghanistan would have given him to us with just the smallest amount of incentive. They essentially, they didn't essentially. Mullah Omar offered him to us. But no, Bush had to have his $3 trillion war. Now it's a $6 trillion war between Iraq and Afghanistan. It's going to be worse than that when everything else is done. Tim in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. This is my first time calling.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me on. I was wanting to make a comment about sort of the broken democracy due to the influence over elections, essentially, is what you guys have been talking a lot about.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, the Koch brothers put out a lot of money to get certain people elected. And they make $6 billion a year now. But the corporate media makes close to $300 billion a year. And they get to decide what goes on the air.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just kind of wondering who really has influence over our democracy.
Well, and the corporate media also knows that $1 billion that the Koch brothers are raising is all going to end up in their pocket. They are not going to bite that hand that feeds them. But yeah, this is the problem that we have in the United States is over the last 35 years, we have seen the rise of not just billionaire power, as a result of Reaganomics. And not just the death of middle-class working person power, taking us from one-third of the country being unionized to virtually nothing. Not only have we seen that, but we have seen the rise of corporate power as well. And corporate power now basically runs this country. And in every major industry, we're playing monopoly. We're down to three or four players in every major industry who control more than 80% of the marketplaces. We have a monopolistic, oligarchic economy and political system right now. And it's not what the founders envisioned. And it is largely brought to you courtesy of right-wingers on the U.S. Supreme Court. Tim, thanks for the call. Jonathan in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Jonathan, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. First time, long time. You have to
thank
excuse
you.
Me. I'm in awe right now. You're the best that ever did it. You, Rachel Maddow, Steph Miller.
Thank you.
I'm grateful for you guys. They say if you're grateful for 10 things a day, your health becomes better. So anyways, my point, I'm a recovering drug addict. I was on the square for Winterfest, and I came across a drug addict selling newspapers. Mm-hmm. And I work at a restaurant. We throw away a bunch of stuff. So I went to my car. I had chicken tenders, cheese curds, soup, bread, cherries, berries, sweatpants, a sweatshirt, threw it in my soccer bag, gave it to her. And I felt selfish. And I got more out of it than she did. And I think Dalai Lama said that we as humans have the benefit to help others. So I encourage anybody just to have a helping hand to just help somebody out. And I love it when you I learned I submit to you. I submit to you that if Obamacare saves one life through recovery care, the whole program is worth it.
Yeah.
And lastly, if I had Coke money, I'd donate all of it because I learned through Dharma that I don't need money to be happy. So I really appreciate you, Tom, and keep doing what you're doing.
Well, thank you, Jonathan, and thank you for your full-throated defense of philanthropy. It's really important stuff. And let me add, by the way, the Hunter School, which I talk about a lot on this program, is a lot of the school districts are paying really late, and they're going through a real crisis right now. I mean, it's like, are we going to make payroll next week? And so if anybody's inclined to help out the Hunter School, they can go over to hunterschool.org and make a donation. They take PayPal and whatnot. And, of course, Free Speech TV is in their fund drive right now as well. Jonathan, thank you for the call. Don in Canonsburg, Pennsylvania. Hey, Don, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I do a puzzle in my local paper called a crypto quote. And the other day, the solution was, the author of this quote was Howard Scott. And he said, a criminal is a person with predator instincts who has not sufficient capital to form a corporation.
Yeah, exactly. Conservatives hate government for the same reason that criminals hate cops.
Yeah, exactly. But, I used to be I'm retired from a public sector job, and I was involved in a union a lot. And I used to get really irritated at the term human resources. And guys would say, why are you so upset? And I said, well, primarily because most of our bosses are conservatives. And a conservative sees a resource not as something to be nurtured, but as something to be exploited. And I think that term used to just hit my nerves.
Oh, me too. And you know, before the 1980s, nobody had ever heard of that term, human resources.
No, exactly. And I said, why can't they call it employee services? Or why do I have to be? I'm not a resource.
Right.
You know, I'm a human being, and I should be treated as a human being. And I think that has a lot to do with the way upper management looks at
yeah, I'm with you. Language has consequences. I'm with you. Well, but Don, you know, welcome to Kokistan, the new empire of the Koch brothers. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. Boy, we've got a whole bunch of really great guests coming up. Stick around. Ian Millhiser will be with us next.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show. So please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. And as I opened the show with an hour ago, Mr. Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel is here in town. He was addressing AIPAC earlier today. He will be addressing Congress at the invitation of Speaker of the House John Boehner without bothering to inform the White House tomorrow. I mean, the White House obviously knows now. And Dr. Trita Parsi is on the line with us, the founder and president of the National Iranian American Council, NIACC. He's also the author of A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran, in addition to a number of other just absolutely brilliant, brilliant books. The website for the National Iranian American Council is niacouncil.org. And Dr. Parsi, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Can you frame for us the Netanyahu perspective on what's going on and the Iranian perspective on what's going on?
Yeah, so if we take the Netanyahu perspective first, we can first talk about what he's saying and what I think a lot of people by now have concluded is what he's actually thinking. What he's saying is that the deal that the United States is negotiating with Iran together with the rest of the members of the Security Council's permanent five members plus Germany, is a deal that ultimately would leave Iran with certain elements of nuclear know-how and technology, which then in and of itself would be an existential threat, even though, of course, the deal will be closing off all of the paths for Iran to get a nuclear weapon. The Iranians would have to sign additional protocol in which the outside world would have almost complete transparency into what's going on in Iran's nuclear program. Despite all of this, Netanyahu government is saying that this is still an existential threat. What I think most people are starting to conclude is that Netanyahu is actually not that concerned about Iran getting a few thousand centrifuges or having a small nuclear program operating. What this is about is that he does not want to see the United States and Iran sign a deal, reduce their own tensions, while Israel will continue to have tensions with Iran. They're afraid that the United States, by signing this deal, would essentially accept Iran's position in the region, its advances geopolitically. From the Israeli perspective, they believe that Iran is aiming for hegemony, and as a result, it needs to be stopped, not be accommodated.
Yeah, although, and Iran, you know, was one of the very first businesses to open in Iraq, was the National Bank of Iran or the Bank of Tehran or whatever it was. But Netanyahu came to the United States in 2002 and talked to Congress as a citizen of Israel and said, please go ahead, invade Iraq. Now, I mean, if you want to, anything in the world that helped Iran was our invasion of Iraq. But it seems like really what he's objecting to, tell me if I have this right, and then I want to hear your take on the Iranian perspective, is what Netanyahu is objecting to is the United States and the UN's General, the Security Council, having a positive, rational relationship with Iran.
I think you're absolutely right, because if the United States has a positive, rational relationship with Iran, gets Iranian help to defeat ISIS, which is the main threat in the region right now, where would that leave Israel in America's considerations for the region? Right. Israel is not particularly helpful against ISIS, nor can it be. It is a small state that constantly says that it needs things from the United States, whereas Iran has things to offer. Now, that's a simplification in many ways, but I think that is part of the fear on the Israeli side. I described it in detail in Treacherous Alliance when I interviewed a very large number of Israeli officials, and it was quite clear to see that they have worries about Iran, and some of those worries are quite legitimate. But this idea that going first from saying that a nuclear Iran would be an existential threat to now saying that a nuclear deal with Iran would be an existential threat, I think by now the Prime Minister of Israel has lost most of his credibility.
Yeah. Yeah. So now, from the Iranian point of view, what's going on?
I think the Iranians have now negotiated with the United States in the P5 plus 1 for about 2 years. These have been very intense and also very productive negotiations. The interim deal that they signed last November, or November 2013, has been very successful. It has made the world a safer place. The Iranians have stopped doing a lot of the sensitive activities in their nuclear program. They have shipped out a large number of their stockpile. They have eliminated large parts of their 20% enriched uranium stockpile. These are very, very positive things that the Prime Minister of Israel, frankly, should thank the United States for. But what I think the Iranians are looking at right now, as they see Netanyahu coming to Congress without being invited by the executive branch and doing everything he can to sabotage his deal, is that I think from the Iranian perspective, they're looking to as this as a litmus test to see who runs America's foreign policy. Right. Is it the President of the United States, or is it the Prime Minister of Israel?
Wow. And is apparently there's a legitimate doubt about that?
Well, again, if we have a scenario in which the President of the United States has staked almost his entire foreign policy legacy on this deal with Iran, he's really committed to it. He has threatened to veto legislation coming out of Congress that would undermine these negotiations several times.
Right.
And I frankly never seen him so committed to anything foreign policy-wise. If he's that committed and still the Prime Minister of Israel can sabotage it and make sure that the President doesn't get a deal, then I think we wouldn't be surprised. We shouldn't be surprised if some countries draw the conclusion that Israel is more influential than the President of the United States.
Wow. Now, if we are successful in Netanyahu being ignored is probably not quite the right word, but whatever. If Netanyahu does not succeed in blowing up this deal, and the United States works out something with Iran that essentially takes the whole nuclear issue off the table, so we can stop, you know, getting hysterical about that and bloviating about it and whatnot. That's no longer a point of conflict between our two countries. Would the next step be, in your opinion, Dr. Tridiparsi, would the next step be for the United States to start talking to Iran about either or direct Iranian military, indirect Iranian military, the Hezbollah connection to Iran, maybe using Hezbollah against ISIS, or am I just like in la-la land here?
No, not really. I mean, Hezbollah is already fighting ISIS right now in Syria. What will happen after a deal? I think first it will be a period in which you're not going to see a significant amount of increased cooperation between the United States and Iran on non-nuclear issues. I think the president will probably use the first couple of months after a deal to calm down the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Kuwaitis, and the Israelis and kind of tell them, look, we've made a deal with Iran, but we haven't abandoned America's allies in the region because we made a deal with Iran. Right.
What would the impact be in Iran? In Iran?
I think it will be immense, because I think this deal is very important to ordinary Iranians, because this will help determine who defines Iran for the next couple of decades. Is it going to be people like Ahmadinejad with his crazy, aggressive rhetoric and his very provocative foreign policy? Or is it going to be more moderate people like the current president, Rouhani, and his foreign minister, Dr. Zarif, who got his PhD here in the United States? If it is the latter, I think Iran may move in a very constructive direction in which it can become a very positive player in the region, and relations with the United States hopefully can improve. If the deal fails, however, then I think I and many others fear that we're going to see Iran move in the opposite direction. The conclusion in Tehran is going to be that, well, you know, Rouhani tried negotiations, it didn't work, so the United States is not going to go back to sanctions and pressure, and Iran will do the same, and we will see a reigniting of this escalatory, confrontational foreign policy between the United States and Iran.
Right. Yeah, it's remarkable. It's absolutely remarkable. Dr. Tridiparsi, founder and president of the National Iranian American Council, NIACC, the website niacouncil.org, and author of A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran, among other just absolutely brilliant books. You've got to come on one of these days and we'll talk theology again. Thank you, Dr. Parsi,
so
much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Great having you with us. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more of the news of the day, my take, your take, and all of the above. Stick around. And welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. A lot going on in the world today. Michael in Williamsburg, Indiana. Hey, Michael. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I was kind of a few days ago, I was watching your show about Washington legalizing marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
Which I want to say congrats to.
You mean Washington, D.C.? Yeah. Thank you.
And
I voted for that. So.
Cool. If I could have been, I would have.
Yeah.
I think marijuana should be legal, recreational, throughout the whole country.
I agree.
And if I could legal skydiving, I kind of know.
Yeah, Michael, your phone is breaking up so badly. I can't tell what you're saying. So I'm not sure what.
Jack, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay. That's the problem. But I can't. You know, I'm with you, and thanks for the good words about. You know, legalization of pot here in D.C. I appreciate it. John in Minneapolis, Minnesota, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, that the intersection between, I think, political economy or politics and the economy, particularly, you know, with this whole idea of supply side economics, it should be, you know, politics needs a free flow of information and truthful information. And unfortunately, what has happened is, you know, that has just been short-circuited. But I discussed this with you, and I think you've discussed this on your, you know, last week about an article that I read in the Daily Kos about our governor here in Minnesota, who, you know, instead of, following austerity, he went ahead and taxed rich people like himself. He's a billionaire.
Right.
And lo and behold, he taxed, wealthy Minnesotans and also increased the minimum wage and also passed a law that women have to be paid the same. And all those things together, plus also another thing too that he did was to make voting easier. You could actually register online. And so I think all of that has contributed to the fact that we have grown 172,000 jobs in less than 4 years, and we are a small state of just over 4 million people, or maybe close to 5 million people, and yet we are up there in the top five, I think four or five.
You're number five in the United States in terms of how rapidly the economy is going and growing and how optimistic people are about it.
Right. And, you know, like I said to begin with, you know, democracy really depends on the free flow of information. That's the way I learned it in my political science class, was that, you know, in previous times when there wasn't a free flow of information, and everything was controlled by the state and the church, you know, things didn't change. Society was static. And one of the geniuses of democracy is that we can, you know, we can change and we can grow and we can do different things. But that is all short-circuited if you don't have, the truth. And why is it, and I think Danielle asks this on Friday, and I called in, you know, why is it that this idea, which is false at this point, is still perpetrated on the rest of us, that, strangling the economy, giving money back to rich people, all of that is working.
Yeah. Well, it's being promoted because it's working for rich people. John, thanks for the call. We'll be back. So we have an economy and a political system now that are both highly dysfunctional, that have been created or modified, shall we say, over the years. And it's been over the years. I mean, this is the political change in this country, the strategic underpinnings for it were laid out by Russell Kirk in 1951 in his book, The Conservative Mind, picked up by William F. Buckley throughout the 60s. Promoted in the early 70s by Lewis Powell in his infamous Powell memo to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce saying, you guys, You know, for 100 years, the Chamber of Commerce has been totally apolitical. It's time to get political, pick a political party, own that political party, go for it. And then, of course, the Powell memo leading to the creation of the Heritage Foundation and the Cato Institute and the American Enterprise Institute and all these other right-wing think tanks heavily funded by right-wing billionaires, the Joe Coors, the Koch brothers, the Richard Mellencamps of the world. And what has happened is between that and the members of the Supreme Court, specifically Scalia and Thomas, who have gone to these Koch brother retreats and been wined and dined and feted and honored and frankly paid. Clarence Thomas neglected to tell us that his wife had taken $800,000 from the Heritage Foundation, you know, another group supported by the Koch brothers over the years. He just, you know, forgot to fill it out year after year after year in his annual required federal employee disclosure form, federal judge disclosure form. If he had been a judge in any other court in the United States, he might be in jail right now. He certainly would no longer be a judge. But because he's on the Supreme Court has asserted that they can write their own damn rules. For example, they're all in favor of freedom of speech for billionaires. Right. We cannot constrain their freedom of speech. You can't stop billionaires from buying any politician that they want, buying as many ads on TV as they want, because that's freedom of speech. But the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that if you try to protest outdoors on public property owned by the federal government in front of the Supreme Court building, you go to jail. No place else in D.C. is that the case. Right. Everywhere in the city, you can show up with a sign that says, you know, I love John Boehner or John Boehner stinks, whatever you want. Or I love Scalia and Alito, or I don't. Anywhere else in the country, anywhere else in the city, you can show up with a sign like that. No problem. You show up with a sign like that and you stand on the sidewalk in front of the Supreme Court, they'll haul your ass off to jail. The Supreme Court really believes in power to the people, right? As long as the people have 7 zeros in their bank account. So what we have seen here in Kokistan, in the new American Republic of Kokistan, is that our economic system has been corrupted. Principally by Reagan stopping the enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act, allowing these mergers and acquisitions, this M&A mania, which has been going on for 35 years. It spawned an industry. Mitt Romney made his billion in this industry. They call it private capital or venture capital or vulture capital it used to be called mergers and acquisitions, M&A artists. I call it hustling. It's a scam. I mean, Mitt Romney makes money not by creating anything of value. He makes money by sucking dry corporations, breaking them up, selling them off, moving them overseas. And it's, of course, not just Mitt Romney. So we now have an economy that's no longer based on making things. It's based on skimming stuff off the top. How much can you skim off the top here or there or the other place? For example, and I think this is just a classic example, we used to believe that education was part of the commons, that education was such an important thing in the United States that we would subsidize it. And one way we subsidized it was we said, if you want to start a school, a college, it's a not-for-profit, right? It's like we started the Hunter School up in New Hampshire, which is having a financially really a tough time right now, by the way. Hunterschool.org, if you can help out in any way, is much appreciated. But we started this back decades ago, and it's a 501c3. It's a not-for-profit. But now we have for-profit schools opening all over the United States, particularly these for-profit colleges, and their principal goal is not even to be in the college business. Their principal goal is to be in the banking business, so that they can loan money to students who will then take their courses and owe them that money and pay a mind-boggling amount of interest over the course of the first 20, 30 years of their working lives. And they don't even provide them with a decent education, so these young people can't make a living. This is how bad it's gotten. Every business, businesses that used to be like just solid, you know, schools, okay, colleges, they have become hustle factories. So our economy has been taken over by the billionaires, and now, thanks to the Supreme Court and Citizens United, our politics have been taken over by the billionaires. Welcome to Kokistan.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Now, what do we do about that? I laid out a prescription for this in my book, the Rebooting the American Dream. There's some very simple, straightforward steps we need to be taking. 33 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, Talk Media, for the sane among us. Tom Hartman here with you, and Ian Millhiser is with us, senior fellow with the Center for American Progress's Action Fund, editor of Think Progress Justice. ThinkProgress.org is the website. Ian, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here. Thanks so much.
Or welcome back, I should say. You wrote a really interesting piece for this for ThinkProgress.org, the Center for American Progress's blog. The odds that each justice will vote to destroy Obamacare. Shall we just go through this really quickly?
Sure.
Okay, let's start with Sam Alito. The odds that Mr. Alito will say, sure, yeah, let's uphold Obamacare. Well, actually, let's start out by just, if you can summarize in a few sentences what the essence of this case, King v. Burwell, is. It's going to be argued before the Supreme Court day after tomorrow.
Sure. No, this is one of the scariest cases that the Supreme Court has heard in many years, and I just wrote a book about them, so I've read a lot of them. The issue in this case is that under the Affordable Care Act, everyone is supposed to receive a tax credit to help them pay for health insurance if they qualify on the basis of income and if they buy insurance through one of the law's health exchanges. This case claims that if basically if you live in the wrong state, if you live in a state where the federal government operates the exchange instead of the state government operating the exchange, then you're out of luck. Then you don't get this tax credit. And what happens if those tax credits go away in those states? First of all, up to 13 million people could lose their health care like that because they won't be able to afford it. Up to 10,000 people a year, according to one estimate, will die if they don't have health insurance that they would otherwise have under the Affordable Care Act. And the healthcare industry itself will be cast into turmoil, which will mean that even people like you and I who might have insurance through some other means could get hit because the whole industry is in chaos and doctors don't know if they're going to get paid. Insurance companies don't know if they can make their budget.
Right. All bets are off. So, you know, it all hangs on these four words that, you know, the exchanges created by the state. Doesn't the word state include the United States of America in terms of legal terminology? If you say state, isn't that a synonym for nation?
Right. So, I mean, I'll disagree with you that it hinges on those four words because, you know, that's what the plaintiffs argue. The plaintiffs point to these few words in the law where it refers to an exchange established by a state. They say a state is not the federal government. It's only one of the 50 states. So, ha, they caught us. No one gets tax credit. But the law is a lot more than four words long. There's a provision of the law that defines the word exchange so that any exchange, whether it's state or federal, counts as an exchange established by the state. There are various provisions of the law that become completely ridiculous if you don't read them to say that state exchanges and federal exchanges are the same thing, including one provision, which if you read it the way that the plaintiffs want to read it, would mean that Congress created exchanges that no one is allowed to buy health care in and no one is allowed to sell health care in.
Right.
So, their reading is just wrong, and the only way you can get to it is if you take those few words completely out of context and you don't read the entire law.
Right. And so what are the odds that Sam Alito will do exactly what you just described?
I quip in my piece that, you know, he's more likely to get struck by lightning while committing voter fraud than to vote to uphold Obamacare. I mean, Justice Alito is the most partisan member of the court. He's very, very conservative.
So you're saying he's a political hack. He's not a judge. I mean,
he is a reliable vote in a case like this for the outcome that the Republican Party wants.
Okay. Now, what about Clarence Thomas? His wife, Ginny, works at the Heritage Foundation, made over $800,000 from them, which he didn't bother to tell us about for a long, long time. And they came up with the original version of Obamacare. I mean, shouldn't he be in favor of it?
You know, here's the thing, and this applies to both Scalia and Thomas. So both of them have said in the past that when you read a law, you have to look at the whole law. You have to look at the statute as a whole, and you can't just read little passages in isolation.
Right. In fact, they just said that last week, rather?
Yeah, I mean, last week there was an opinion where eight justices joined one decision or the other, saying that yes, you have to read the whole law. You know, Scalia and Thomas have said that over and over again. So if they follow their own decisions, we've got them. But the chances that they're going to follow their own decisions, look, I mean, Scalia wrote an opinion before the last Obamacare case that made it clear that the law was constitutional, but he didn't feel the need to follow it when, you know, the Affordable Care Act was on the chopping block. So, you know, I'm not optimistic about either one of them.
Right. Okay, so probably less than 50-50 on Scalia and Thomas. Judge Kennedy.
I'd say less than 10% on them.
Okay. That's three votes. We have to get to five in order to strike down Obamacare. Justice Kennedy, he's occasionally a swing vote.
Yeah, I mean, Justice Kennedy, it starts to get a little bit interesting. You know, he hates this law. He was the one who, in the last case, was actively lobbying Roberts to try to get the whole law struck down. So, you know, that's a big, you know, the fact that he had such a stake in this case probably dictates what his vote is going to be. That said, there are two things that could get him. One is that there's a really strong states' rights argument in this case that essentially you can't surprise the state by saying, oh, by the way, that decision you made a while back between whether to have a state or federal exchange, if you thought meant nothing, actually it means that your citizens lose billions of dollars worth of tax credits. Bye-bye now. So Justice Kennedy is normally a big advocate of states' rights, and it might be that he's offended by this attempt to surprise the states with the consequence that they couldn't have anticipated.
Right.
The other thing is that because similar language is used to the language the plaintiffs rely on, the exchange established by the state language, is used in a provision governing children's health care, it's possible that up to 5 million children could lose health insurance if this case goes badly. And Kennedy, you know, the one place where he has shown a fair amount of compassion is for children.
Hmm.
So it's possible that he'll pause there. I wouldn't put money on him. I think the chance that we get him is 15, maybe 20%. But he is more in play than many of the other concerns.
Yeah, so he has a little empathy. So unlike Scalia and Thomas, he's probably not a sociopath. Interesting. So we're up to now four votes to strike down Obamacare. John Roberts would make the fifth. This Obamacare came before the court a couple years ago, and he did a kind of Solomonic, let's cut the baby down the middle by saying states can opt out of the Medicaid expansion if they want.
Right.
And he got a lot of flack for that on the right. On the other hand, he got a lot of praise for it from kind of the, I guess you would call it the Main Street Republicans, the pragmatists.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's possible. You know, Roberts is the one that everyone's looking at in this case. I say we have about a 50-50 chance of getting him. You know, Roberts has shown that he is very cautious, at least said in the past, that he's very cautious about the court appearing too political.
Right.
And here you have a case, you know, it's the most contentious law in a generation. You know, the Republican Party is gung-ho for the law, the Republican Party is gung-ho against the law, the Democratic Party is gung-ho for it. This lawsuit, like, I can't actually use the word on the air that I would use to describe this lawsuit. But, like, you know, the legal theory that the plaintiffs have presented is just not a strong theory. I mean, it's really a crackpot legal theory.
Right.
And multiple commentators, prominent commentators, and not just liberal commentators, a lot of reporters have come forward and said, look, like, this just isn't what the law says. That's not what it's supposed to do. Of course there should be exchanges in all 50 states. And so given this toxic mix of a legal theory that has no real substance and all the politics behind it, what a lot of people are hoping is that will be enough to get Robert to say, oh, maybe I should do the right thing here. Maybe I should actually follow the law, because if I do what my party wants me to do, I'm going to look like a hack and my court's going to lose its credibility. And that's what we're counting on. We're counting on Roberts caring enough about the legitimacy of his institution that he doesn't want to blow it up by handing down such a hackish decision.
What does it say about the state of our democracy, Ian Millhiser, that we're even having this conversation about the virtual certainty that 4 out of 9 justices on the United States Supreme Court are going to make a ruling for which there's no possible legal explanation or rationalization? It's just purely partisan.
Well, I mean, honestly, I think it says something about the Supreme Court as an institution. You know, I mean, I mentioned that I have a book. It's called Injustices, and it's about the history of the Supreme Court. And, you know, the history of the Supreme Court is, you know, they struck down child labor laws, they upheld segregation, they struck down the minimum wage, and they upheld eugenics. There was actually a case where the Supreme Court said that a woman could be cut open against her will and a surgeon could take out her fallopian tubes.
Right.
So, like, the Supreme Court throughout almost all of its history has been terrible.
It's been one of our most conservative institutions. Wait, is your book out, by the way, Ian?
Well, I'm sorry?
Is your book out?
It is out at the end of this month, March 24th. It's available for pre-order on Amazon. Once again, it's called Injustices.
Injustices by Ian Millhiser. Be sure to, you know, send us a press release or something. I'd like to get you on both radio and TV to plug the book and let people know about it. It sounds fascinating.
Absolutely. I'll very much look forward to that.
Yeah. So here in the last 20, 30 seconds, do you think that the arguments on Wednesday are going to inform us of how they're going to rule?
It's a good question. You know, what happened the last time around is Roberts, remember, initially voted to strike down most of the Affordable Care Act, and then he flipped and he decided to uphold most of it instead. So, you know, we could be in for a really bumpy ride on Wednesday, and then it might be that Roberts realizes that he doesn't want to destroy the legitimacy of his court, so he flips.
Right.
You know,
or it could be the other way around.
We'll know for sure.
Yeah, amazing. Ian Millhiser, thank you, Ian.
You're listening Tom Hartman.
Hang on just
a
second.
Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Guy always steps on me and my guests. Ian Millhiser, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. Your new book, Ian, the title?
Injustices.
Check it out. Thank you, Ian. And welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And David, watching Free Speech TV in Shawnee, Oklahoma. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom.
Hey. What's up?
Man, I appreciate what you do.
Thank you.
I was listening to your rant on Beebe this morning,
mm-hmm.
and several other stories. I'm nervous talking to me, so you forgive me. But right. I think the biggest story is that some of your stories aren't the biggest stories on the regular news. I've got to go to you or Amy.
I agree.
Find out about these things.
I agree. We no longer have news in this country. We have infotainment. We have very carefully selected infotainment that works to the benefit of the big corporations and the billionaires and to the detriment of average working people in America.
Well, it's great for America's funniest videos. I bet anybody that watched the news Friday saw the llamas.
Yeah. Yeah, or if you want to see our prisons being glorified, you know, that's MSNBC every night. If you want to, you know. It's like, you know, the police state, you know, half of our dramas on television are about cops and you know, various dimensions of policing. It's like we've become something pretty hard to recognize. It's truly astonishing.
Speaking of policing, Amy broke the story, I believe it was Friday, about the quote-unquote black site that the Chicago police were running.
Yeah, we talked about that last week. That's mind-boggling, too.
Why isn't that on the front page of every newspaper? Why isn't that the lead story on every network? I just don't understand.
I don't either. I genuinely don't. Either the networks believe that there's something fishy about the story, which is possible, or the networks don't want to be accused of messing in Democratic politics, Chicago politics, you know, Rahm Emanuel, he's in charge and he's up for re-election. Or there's pressure on the networks from the Democratic Party, from the White House, from Rahm Emanuel. Who knows? I mean, I have no idea. Nobody's called me up and said, don't cover this story. But you're right. I can't find it anywhere. It's fairly hard to find. It's out there, but it's fairly hard to find. Excellent points, David. Thank you for the call on that. And with regard to Netanyahu's visit, the friends, people in Shawnee, Oklahoma, where you live, David, does anybody care?
I hate to say it, Tom, but you probably have to go through 100 to find 2 or 3 or 4.
Yeah, who even really know what's going on?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, this well, is, you know.
I mean, we probably got a higher percentage of Fox News viewers around here than pretty much anywhere in the country.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's.
And I feel guilty sometimes. I feel like, well, I should watch that to at least know what I'm talking. And I swear, it just makes my skin crawl. I can't watch him for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Can't make myself do it.
I have the same problem, and definitely can't do it before bed. It really screws up my sleep. But it's, you know, the elite billionaires like Rupert Murdoch and elite multimillionaires like Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity, they have developed a program to cause average working people to think that their interests are the same as the elite billionaires and millionaires. It's astonishing how successful they've been at doing it. David, thank you for the call, and thanks for watching us there in Shawnee, Oklahoma. We'll be back. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, for some reason, my call screen software has locked up. David's still on the line. David, are you there? No? Huh. Let me just see if sometimes clicking on it makes it work, even though it doesn't show it. Victoria, are you there?
I am.
Aha! Okay, well, we're taking your Skype audio. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News, and I'm going to just quit out of this. Software. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Victoria, what's going on in the world today?
A great deal going on in the world. The fight over how to fund the Department of Homeland Security, you may think it was going away after they magically managed to fund the department for a whole week on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
But no, it hasn't gone away. Senators are expected tonight to take a procedural vote over whether or not to move towards a conference committee with House lawmakers, which is something Republicans want. Democrats don't want. Because House Republicans want to use the time to reach a deal on getting rid of President Obama's executive actions on immigration, as well as how to fund the department. So Senate Democrats have vowed to block any attempt to go to conference, so they plan to block any attempt to vote on this bill tonight.
Hmm.
So we're going nowhere again.
Yeah. Yeah. Welcome to politics 2016 or 2015. It's all gridlock all the time.
Yes, all gridlock all the time. Very, very thrilling. As you know, there is a big Obamacare case before the Supreme Court this coming Wednesday. And a new poll out conducted, a survey conducted by Hart Research Associates for the Service Employees International Union says that 61% of people hope that the subsidies, which are at risk in this case, are upheld.
In other words, the subsidies continue to be available.
Continue to be available, correct.
Wow.
They would be opposed to a Supreme Court decision gutting that key provision of Obamacare. And also, even if the Supreme Court rules against the Obama administration, most people believe the subsidies should still be available. A total of 71% of people said it shouldn't matter whether states set up their own exchanges in order to qualify for the subsidies.
Wow.
Which is a significant number.
Yeah, it is. That's quite substantial. I do you know if among Republicans it's over 50%?
It's not as high as that. Obviously, it breaks down lower than that, but it doesn't give me a major breakdown here between Republicans and Democrats. It just gives an overall figure.
Right. Okay. What else is up
in my story? There's new gun legislation being introduced by Representative Tom Rooney, Republican of Florida, the Protecting Second Amendment Rights Act. This is to push back against a policy from the Obama administration effectively banning armor-piercing ammunition. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms proposed last week to prohibit gun companies from manufacturing and selling 5.56 millimeter projectiles for M855 cartridges that provide ammunition for AR-15 rifles. But Republicans are saying it would trample on hunters' Second Amendment rights.
Wait a minute. Hunters need armor-piercing? I've never seen a deer running around in an SUV.
You haven't?
No. No, I mean, right. I've seen them tied to the front of them. But, you wouldn't need armor-piercing bullets to get a deer that's tied to the front of a car. But why would Republicans say that hunters need armor-piercing ammunition?
Well, Rooney said in a statement, the Obama administration's proposal would unilaterally strip law-abiding hunters and sportsmen of their Second Amendment rights. Congress has made its intentions clear that this ammunition is for sporting purposes and should not be restricted. Now, law enforcement has weighed in on this, and a lot of police are very concerned about these bullets because they do pierce, the
armor.
The armor that you wear.
Yeah.
So they are concerned about this. Now, they're in a comment phase at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see what happens.
Is there any possibility that the police unions around the country or police departments around the country are going to get together and make enough noise about this? I mean, Republicans have a hard time shouting down cops.
I think there's a possibility about this. I would imagine that this bill clearly has the backing of the NRA. It would be interesting to see whether there's a split between the different police unions on this.
Yeah, yeah, it definitely would.
Yeah.
What else is up?
Well, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu did give a speech today to the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee saying that my speech is not intended to show any disrespect for President Obama or the office that he holds. I have great respect for both. This, of course, a precursor to his big speech tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern to a joint session of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
But he made it very clear that he believes he has a moral obligation to speak up and that he wants to, it seems, stop any kind of nuclear deal that may be moving forward. And a senior official on his plane coming over from Israel said that he plans to say something about some of the things that are in the deal that is being discussed.
How could he know those?
Obama administration officials have said that he doesn't know what's in the deal, but Secretary of State John Kerry today issued a veiled warning to him against revealing what might be in the deal.
So, in other words, Israeli spies might have hacked the communications of either Iran or the United States, and thus he may be privy to highly confidential, very sensitive information. And they're
or
concerned
something
that
might have been leaked. I don't know.
Yeah, and they're concerned that he's going to blow this out on the floor of the House. Amazing. Okay. What else is up?
The Senate's going to vote to override President Obama's veto of legislation authorizing the Keystone XL pipeline, probably on Thursday.
Yeah, good luck with that, right?
Yeah, they probably have 63 votes. They don't have 67.
There you go. Okay. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Always great seeing you. Stick around. We're going to be back. Dr. Malik Burnett is going to be with us, the Office of National Drug Affairs and Drug Policy Alliance.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. and EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. So glad to have you with us. Dr. Malik Burnett is with us, a doctor as in medical doctor, MD. He's the policy manager for the Office of National Affairs, the Drug Policy Alliance. Drugpolicy.org is the website. And Dr. Burnett, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
It is a pleasure and an honor to have you with us. So D.C., pot is legal in D.C. What's going on with that?
Yeah, so last Thursday, Initiative 71, which was a voter-approved initiative, 70% of district residents voted on November 4th, legalizes the personal possession of up to 2 ounces of marijuana for individuals over the age of 21 and allows them to grow 6 plants in their home. It largely was run under the issue of ending marijuana prohibition due to the fact that the district has probably the most egregious enforcement of marijuana laws. You're 8 times more likely as an African-American to be arrested for marijuana possession in the district, in spite of the fact that marijuana use is equal across race. And so,
well, in fact, actually, with a lot of drugs, there's more abuse among white people than people of color.
That is correct.
Particularly cocaine and things.
Yeah. So, you know, it was largely a effort around the first in the country focused squarely around the issue of racial justice. And, you know, the issue of racial justice is intimately linked to the marijuana legalization movement.
Isn't it fascinating how little of that conversation has bled out into the public, into the mass media? Do you think that's because the private prison industry and the police industry and the incarceration industry and everything are just so pervasive and so powerful that our corporate media doesn't want to take them on?
You know, I think that you know, could play a significant role. What I'm always fascinated by is that everyone, when we're talking about the issue of marijuana legalization, talks about the kids and, like, what is the message that we're sending to kids? And, you know, I always respond by saying, what is it the message that we're sending to kids when we can use, you know, marijuana as a gateway to the, you know, criminal justice system? We incarcerate the most people in the world in the United States, and largely people who are supporting prohibition of marijuana say marijuana is a gateway drug. This has been soundly debunked by the Institute of Medicine. But what it is it's a gateway to the criminal justice system. People use marijuana as the pretext for stops, and they use marijuana as a way to find other crimes that they can find longer jail sentences for and end up putting people in federal prison.
Right. And thus we have 4% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners.
That's correct.
And about half of them are there for things that have to do with drugs.
That's correct.
That's mind-boggling.
It's incredible.
It's just mind-boggling. So we're taking a step in the right direction here in the district. What are the what's the latest science about marijuana? I know people who claim that pot will prevent cancer. Mm-hmm. Tommy Chong is famously taking pot oil to treat
right.
prostate cancer,
right.
and now he's saying, "Hey, I'm cancer free," or something like that. I mean,
right.
You know, I've read about these oils, and, you know, I forget the guy's name, Dr. Somebody or Other's oil, and all this stuff.
Right.
Is that hyperbole?
No, you know, while it is very difficult to conduct research here in the United States around marijuana, there is a robust array of research from international locales. Israel is a prominent leader in the world around cannabis research. There has definitely been promising research that shows that cancer is anti-neoplastic, meaning it has cancer-fighting properties. There's been lots of anecdotal evidence of people using cannabis for, you know, combating cancer and remaining cancer free. It also, as you know, is widely known here in the United States in a medical capacity in helping to treat epilepsy and Dravet syndrome, which is a condition that children have where they have hundreds of seizures a day. And, you know, once they get on cannabidiol, which is CBD, they're likely to see their seizure incidence decrease to, you know, 1 to 2 a week, if not less.
Which is better than you would have gotten with old-fashioned things like phenobarbital.
They
can kill you.
Right. They those drugs have an incredible side effect profile. You know, not only are you likely to have some things like agranulocytosis, which is a disease condition where you basically lose all of your blood cells or white blood cells, and you know it makes you incredibly difficult to combat infection, but you know you have all the associated side effects of incredible drowsiness, incredible disorientation, and you don't really have that sort of a harsh side effect profile with cannabis, and that's why people are strongly gravitating towards it as an alternative therapy.
That's remarkable. And in fact, I recall it was just a few weeks ago, I read it on the air. There was a study of long-term pot smokers.
Right.
And the question was, does long-term smoking of pot, these were not vaporizers or
right.
inhalers or tinctures or whatever,
right.
does long-term smoking cause an increase in the lung cancer rate?
Right.
And what they found was, it was a 20-year longitudinal study.
Yep.
People who had smoked pot daily for more than 20 years actually had a lower lung cancer incident than people who don't smoke at all.
That's correct.
And apparently that's because pot actually has an anti-cancer effect.
That is correct. You know, it is very interesting that you bring up that story. So that study was originally sanctioned by National Institutes of Drug Abuse under trying to find the exact opposite effect that, you know, chronic use of marijuana exactly causes, you know, increased incidence of cancer in people who, you know, use marijuana on a regular basis. But, you know, what ended up happening is that the study author, after many, many, many years of research, could not conclude that. And so naturally, you know, being the scientist and, you know, staying true to the science that he is, he just came out and said that this has, you know, been disproven. Like, we've looked at this for 20 years and we can't find data that supports our original hypothesis, so, you know, we're going to say the opposite.
Astonishing. So physiologically, I've also seen studies that imply, I think that everything that's been done in this is epidemiological, but maybe I'm wrong, you would know, that pot actually, also for people, older people, people
right.
in their 40s, 50s,
right.
60s, 70s, 80s, that pot slows the rate of dementia and
yeah.
acts as a neuroprotectant against things like Alzheimer's. Is that an exaggeration?
No, it is very funny that you mentioned that. This is a great opportunity to highlight the incredible incongruence in U.S. policy on this. So as your listeners know, cannabis is considered a Schedule I drug, meaning it has no accepted medical value and high potential for abuse. While at the same time, the United States owns a patent on cannabinoids as neuroprotectants. So the United States is the sole owner of the...
And that patent was from the 90s.
Yeah, that patent was filed,
recent.
Yeah, filed in the I think it was in the late 80s, early 90s,
okay.
around that time
okay.
frame. But, you know, it is, they essentially own all the rights to cannabinoids as medicines. The United States government does. And,
wow.
And yet and still they claim that, you know... cannabis has no medical value. But we are seeing some daylight. U.S. Surgeon General came out a couple weeks back and said that they are now having preliminary results around medical benefits of cannabis. And so we're seeing D.C., you know, legalized, which has national implications certainly for policy reform. So
yeah.
we're moving slowly but surely in the right direction on
well,
this.
And it seems if you're looking at pot as a medicine.
Right.
Or and I've shared my experience on the air. It's a great sleeping pill too if you get the right kind.
Sure.
You know, when we were out in Washington State, if you're using it therapeutically, the biggest danger is getting pot that's contaminated with pesticides or herbicides or some other psychoactive chemical. Which means that the biggest danger about pot right now is where it's illegal, where
exactly.
you have to deal with criminals to get it.
Right. No, I think that that's a very salient point that you make. It is largely one we make when we work on trying to end marijuana prohibition in various jurisdictions. Fundamentally, it's about, you know, controlling and understanding where the supply is coming from, taking it out of the hands of the criminal element, which has, you know, no incentive to adhere to good manufacturing practices, you know, proper care, avoiding the pesticides, the funguses, you know, all of those sort of negative things. And then not only that, they have no incentive to check IDs. So all the people who are making arguments about, you know, the messages to kids, well, drug dealers certainly don't check IDs. So it's actually, we've seen in Colorado a decrease in usage of marijuana amongst individuals less than 21 years old.
If you have, can you stick around and answer
yeah,
some
sure.
questions? If you have a question for Dr. Burnett, give us a call. If you have any you know, medical question about pot, whatever it may be, give us a shout. He's right here in the studio. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Dr. Malik Burnett, MD, drugpolicy.org is the website. He's the policy manager of the Office of National Affairs with the Drug Policy Alliance. Welcome back. Dr. Burnett, let's just continue this conversation. If somebody lives in a jurisdiction where pot is legal, because right. I don't want to be advising anybody to break the law.
Correct.
So if somebody's living in a jurisdiction where pot is legal, which right now is Colorado, Washington State, Alaska, Washington, D.C., and I believe Oregon. Right. I don't know if they've totally legalized yet.
Their ballot initiative hasn't taken effect yet. It'll take effect this, I believe, July.
Okay. So if you live in one of those places or you know, at that point in time, and there's several other states that are looking at this, how should a person introduce themselves? Say somebody is thinking, you know, maybe I should try this out. Maybe it'll help me sleep. Maybe using it occasionally would be a better recreational drug than alcohol. I mean, we know that alcohol actually does increase the rate at which, you know, the speed with which dementia comes on.
Right.
You know, it's a demyelinating agent. It's destructive to the nervous system. Pot's the exact opposite. How should somebody introduce themselves to marijuana?
You know, that's an excellent question. Largely, the advice that I would give is to, you know, take it slowly. I think that most of your listeners may have seen Maureen Dowd of the New York Times write a column on, you know, eating marijuana edibles, and, you know, having a bad experience. But that just only goes to show that, you know, you should probably take your time and you know, wait to see what the effects are. So take a little, if you're having an infused product, have a small portion. Largely, the issue around edibles is, I think, one that is largely occurring because the industry is very new, and they haven't worked out the kinks in terms of, you know, right-sized dosaging and right-sized packaging. But that's something that will be solved over time as the industry matures, and, you know, the whole branding for kids will probably disappear as well. So I think that, you know, what I'd say to your listeners is take it slowly. Wait to see the effects, understand how it feels for you. Ultimately, know that, you know, you're not going to overdose and you're not going to, you know, have a negative reaction. At the very worst, you'll feel a little strange for a couple of hours and it'll go away and you'll wake up tomorrow with no hangover and be great.
Right. And for those people who might be kind of on, oh, and by the way, if you have a question for Dr. Burnett about medical marijuana in your own particular circumstances, you know, are you using opiate painkillers, for example, and you'd like to look at pot as an alternate, whatever it may be, feel free to give us a shout right now. We'll put you on the air right after the break. Alcohol-based tinctures, the way that we titrate dose with regard to alcohol and pot, it has to do with instantaneous access, right? Alcohol goes through the lining of the stomach, unlike water, and so it gets right into the bloodstream very rapidly. So it's unusual that people overdose on alcohol because they know how high they are. Same thing with pot when you smoke it. If you're taking an alcohol pot tincture, does that alcohol transport the cannabinols across the stomach lining into the bloodstream?
So, I mean, broadly, you have cannabinoid receptors all throughout your body. You have actually, like, much like you have a cardiovascular system, a respiratory system, you have an endocannabinoid system as well. So there are receptors lining your entire body where, you know, your body binds those cannabinoids in and then has a reaction to them. I think that largely when you're eating an infused product, the product has to be digested, and then once it's digested, broken down, those cannabinoids come across. For alcohol-based tinctures, it's no different than that. Like, I don't think that you get an additional assistance from the alcohol-based tinctures in the alcohol itself. It doesn't work.
Okay. So you still have to wait the half hour or hour?
Yeah.
Dr. Burnett is with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Dr. Malik Burnett, MD, is in the studio with us, policy manager with the Office of National Affairs for the Drug Policy Alliance, drugpolicy.org. We've been talking about tinctures and oils and pot and what do you do and actual kind of sort of medical. I mean, you're a medical doctor, medical advice. What's the deal? And if you have a question for Dr. Burnett, give us a shout. Adam in Bolingbrook, Illinois, you are on the air with Dr. Burnett.
Hi, I have a question. First, I am a big supporter of not only your show, Tom, but Dr. Burnett and the Drug Policy Alliance.
Thank you.
In California, they are ruling Judge Kimberly Mueller. I'm not too sure the name of the case. It's, I think, United States versus Parker. A couple guys were growing weed on federal land, and they are stating that it is not a Schedule I drug. Therefore, they cannot be brought up on charges of this.
Yeah, no, that is correct. There is a case currently on under consideration in California where the defendants are making the claim that cannabis has medicinal value and therefore is not a Schedule I drug.
Oh, because by making it Schedule I, the government is asserting baldly, right on its face,
right,
that there's no medical value.
Right, and so it's kind of one of these cases where, you know, the implications of the decision, because the defendants were crafty in arguing their case, is one that if the judge ultimately decides that cannabis is not a correct designation for Schedule I, it will certainly open up the question as to declaring whether or not it's unconstitutional to list cannabis as a Schedule
I
drug.
So this go all the way to the Supreme Court.
Exactly.
Amazing.
It has implications. There's a number of cases like that, though.
Yeah. So we were talking before about if somebody wanted to try pot and they live in a jurisdiction where it's legal, because
right,
we don't want to be advising people to do anything that might put them at legal peril.
Right.
Start with small quantities. My personal advice would be start just before bedtime.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, if you don't like the experience, and in fact, if you've got any sleeping pills kicking around, my understanding is that most of your basic sleeping pills that are available don't have the kind of effect with pot that they might have with alcohol, where it's synergistic as opposed to additive.
Right. So there's not a lot of, cross drug interactions between cannabis and other drugs, which is, you know, largely why a lot of people consider it as sort of an alternative medical therapy. The way it's metabolized in the body, it doesn't lend itself towards those sort of things. While, you know, I would probably advise just taking the cannabis on its own. I'm not
saying mix it with sleeping pills.
Right.
My point, well, I was thinking, you mentioned Maureen Dowd earlier.
Right.
And when I read her column, I thought, you know, if she had a sleeping pill with her.
Right.
And she was having a bad experience, she could just take the sleeping pill and go to sleep and she'd be fine in the morning when she woke up. And instead she laid there for 6 hours hallucinating and having a horrible time.
Right.
And I'm like, man, you know, it's like, and I don't think that there's any medical danger. Now, you're the doctor, I'm not, but I don't, you know, I know there can be a huge medical danger taking sleeping pills with alcohol.
Right.
But with pot?
Yeah, that is largely unstudied. I wouldn't necessarily step out on a limb and say that that's A-okay and, you know, sign off on it completely. But, you know, like I said, there's not been any sort of documented studies of significant drug interactions between, you know, the profile of sleeping pills and cannabis. So I don't necessarily know if you'd have that same sort of synergistic effect that you do with alcohol. But largely, you know, if people are having a bad experience, it is compounded by their own, you know, general sense of panic.
Mm-hmm.
And largely what you should probably do is relax and understand that this is part of the experience. Calm down. Nothing bad will happen. Don't call 911 because you will end up on the internet and people will probably laugh at you. And, you know, just relax. It's going to be okay.
That is great. Okay, we got a bunch of questions here for you. Robert,
sure,
in Cornelius, North Carolina, you're on the air with Dr. Burnett.
Gentlemen, first, Tom, really love your show.
Thank you.
And yes, sir. And Dr. Burnett, I wanted to let everybody know that North Carolina is going to be bringing up House Bill 78. Our state representative, Kelly Alexander, has been very brave. He's brought the bill up a few times, and it's been killed in committee in a variety of unscrupulous ways, more than once. And he's bringing it back again. And so that's just for everybody to know. North Carolina House Bill 78,
great,
enact Medical Cannabis Act. And then I wanted to ask the doctor, how would he suggest communicating this to the public? I might be working with the representative on some of his PR, and I wanted to know, what's a good way to speak to people who aren't familiar with the subject or aren't even open to it?
Well, you know, I think that largely you can talk about the fact that people actually need this, you know, providing a human face to the needs of people who are seeking medical marijuana, whether it be people who are having epilepsy, people who are, you know, undergoing chemotherapy for cancer, people who largely have an array of different medical ailments, MS, multiple sclerosis, a number of different neurological diseases. Bring them and let them be the face of it, because it's ultimately them who need the access, and they can move.
And little kids with seizures are great salespeople,
right,
for this.
They can move the needle in ways that, you know, rhetoric can't.
Okay. We have just 1 minute till the break. Teresa in San Clemente. Quick question for Dr. Burnett.
Yes, I have suddenly got asthma in my 60s, which I've never had before. And they put me on, like, steroid inhalers, which I don't really think are working. But my husband and I do smoke marijuana. I do it occasionally. Is that a bad thing to do if I've got asthma?
The effects of marijuana, it's a bronchodilator, meaning it opens up your airways, which is, you know, the exact sort of thing that you want to do in asthma. People use steroids because it helps limit the inflammation, which is largely another byproduct of it. So, you know, I would recommend considering vaporization, not necessarily smoking. It's a little less harsh on the lungs, but, you know, hopefully that that gives you a little bit of relief.
By vaporizing, you're actually applying the essential oils or the,
right,
the ingredients to the bronchus, to the,
right,
to the part that's going through the problems,
right,
with asthma.
Right.
That's fascinating. Dr. Burnett, thanks so much for dropping by. Actually, I got a bunch more calls here. You want to stick around for a little while?
Sure, I can answer some questions.
Cool. Okay. If you have questions about pot, give us a call. And Dr. Malik Burnett, MD, policy manager with the Office of National Affairs of the Drug Policy Alliance, drugpolicy.org, in the studio with us. We'll be back in 5 minutes.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Drugpolicy.org is their website. Stick around. Slightly unbalanced. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dr. Malik Burnett, MD, policy manager for the Office of National Affairs, the Drug Policy Alliance, drugpolicy.org, is in the studio with us today answering your questions about medical or recreational pot. Keep in mind two quick things. Number one, I can't offer medical advice. I think you can, but there are some limitations on,
sure,
what we can do nationally. So every answer is going to be not, here's what you should do about your case, but here's what a person in those kind of circumstances might do,
right,
number one. And number two, do not do this in a state where you could go to jail for it. So, you know, pretty straightforward stuff. Joe in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Good show. I've been for pot legalization for 20, 30 years now. But I have a question for the doctor and for you, Tom. Is that, what would your view be if pot marketing and manufacturing was undertaken by, say, Reynolds or Lorillard, or say some of the alcohol industry started to make it really commercial and mainstream? I've often joked with my, I'm a libertarian, but I've also often joked with my liberal friends that way to get liberals to oppose pot legalization would be to have R.J. Reynolds start doing it.
Right.
And
okay, Joe, let's get Dr. Burnett's thoughts on that. I'll tell you mine. First of all, is I would welcome it. I think that doing things with small industry is great. And if Reagan hadn't stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, we would have a lot more small and medium sized businesses in this country. And that's a whole nother discussion of a whole nother issue, which is the way that the economy, you know, as Elizabeth Warren says, the game is rigged. The game is rigged for big corporations. So I consider it relatively inevitable that the big alcohol companies, the big tobacco companies are going to be selling pot in the next 5-10 years. And I'd much rather have them selling pot than tobacco or alcohol. Your thoughts, sir?
So I actually would push back on that and say,
cool,
that I think that, you know, this argument about big marijuana is just Reefer Madness 2.0.
Really?
If you actually look at the way that states are industry is taking shape in states, each and every state is deciding to write its own unique policy. And, you know, what would be required is not only a federal end to prohibition, but, like, you would have to repeal every single state's Controlled Substances Act law. What people mostly don't understand is that the Controlled Substances Act is perpetuated in every single state legislature, and so you'd have to roll back each and every single state's own drug laws
well.
And
the other thing that blows up my argument is that you can grow this stuff in your backyard or in your kitchen window.
You know? Right. I think that, you know, a closer sort of industry that you could link this to would be like the wine industry or to the craft brewery industry. There's so much variety with inside cannabis that it doesn't necessarily lend itself to like one size fits all where one brand can take over the entire country. Not only that, I think that largely the arguments around big marijuana exist in a vacuum because what we in the public health space have learned over the past, you know, 50 years on this issue is how to effectively regulate things so that, you know, people are not overwhelmingly abusing them. Certainly we'll have some people who will have problematic use, but largely, you know, the mistakes around advertising to kids and, you know, large commercial sorts of advertising are not necessarily going to repeat in this space, I don't think.
And yet the big acquisition targets right now for in the tobacco industry, or in the alcohol industry rather, are the craft brewers and a lot of the vineyards. I mean, Gallo owns all kinds of different brands that people walk into the store and they have no idea it's Gallo, and the some of the big beer company, Budweiser owns a whole bunch of different craft beer brands.
Yeah.
So maybe there'll be some sort of in between, but you're right. Every state would that's way down the road.
Right. Yeah. It's not anytime soon. It would take at least, you know, 15 to 20 years.
Okay. Kay in Everett, Washington. Kay, you're down the air with Dr. Burnett. Kay? Oh, Kay vanished. I hope that doesn't mean that our phone system is crashing again. Joe in Tucson, Arizona. Joe, can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, Tom.
Great.
I love your show.
Yeah, thank you. You're on the air with Dr. Burnett.
You're on Dish and DirecTV.
Yes.
But I've got a quick question for the doctor. What? I get cluster headaches. I've had them for over 20 years. Dozens of different medicines, and nothing works. Would cannabis help at all, or is there any studies on it?
So there are some preliminary studies. Cluster headaches are largely caused by a constriction of the blood vessels inside the head is similar to temporal headaches. You're in Arizona. The Arizona is a very, very robust medical marijuana state. I don't necessarily believe that it would hurt for you to try it out. It's certainly an alternative therapy, and it's certainly better for you than...
So find a doctor, get a prescription, and check it out. Okay, cool. Alice in Toledo, Oregon. Hey, Alice, you're on the air with Dr. Burnett.
Hi, thank you so much. I appreciate your time. This is an excellent segment. My question is, once and for all, is cannabis physically addictive or psychological dependency occurs from long-term use? And could you compare that to, let's say, the long-term use of sugar, alcohol, caffeine, tobacco? And another debate that I would like to have is whether or not cannabis is actually really a drug, and or does it just feed into the ability for the federal government to hold cannabis at the federal Schedule I status? And if everybody was so worried about the kids, wouldn't we also be hearing a lot about the development of comprehensive harm reduction education?
Oh, good stuff, Alice.
That was a series of great questions. So I'll kind of try to tackle them one by one. So people can become physically dependent. About 9% of people who use cannabis become physically dependent, but it is largely similar to a dependency profile for, you know, sugar or caffeine or something like that. You have a 9% dependency rate with cannabis. You can compare that to a closer to 20% dependency rate with alcohol and somewhere upwards of 25 to 30% dependency rate with tobacco. And then so on and so forth up to scale with other illicit drugs.
Right.
So the dependency profile of cannabis is significantly less. And then, you know, the side effects when you're kind of coming off are very, very mild, irritability,
sleeplessness,
that sort of thing.
So is there a physiological mechanism or is this a psychological process?
I think with dependency, those two are always, it's a little bit of both. The answer is always it's a little bit of both. There's certainly a habit forming component, as with, you know, depending on the way you consume it, but I think there's a little bit of physical dependency as well.
Right.
The caller had another question as it relates to harm reduction strategies, and I think that The way I want to tackle that one is, when you are talking about ending prohibition, you're actually opening the conversation to alternative sort of discussions around drug use. You can actually introduce the concept of what responsible drug use looks like. You can, you know, educate your kids and beyond saying just say no, because that doesn't necessarily equip them with, you know, how they should handle themselves in a day-to-day world where these sort of issues come up. You can talk about, you know, all right, you shouldn't necessarily overindulge anything that you use to excess is problematic. All those sorts of conversations are now possible. And, you know, we provide literature to kind of help have this discussion. Safety First is a publication that you can find on our website, drugpolicy.org.
Drugpolicy.org is the website. And you and another physician also do a Ask the Doctor column.
Right, right. This is my colleague, Amanda Ryman. She's a PhD. We do it at the Docs column, which you can also find on our website, drugpolicy.org.
Drugpolicy.org. Tom, in Jamestown, New York, you're on the air with Dr. Burnett.
Yes, I just wanted to say to the doctor that as a veteran, it has helped me to use less opiates given to me by the Veterans Administration. And, you know, while I'm in another state, of course, because I travel out of the state quite a bit, and it helps me for my PTSD and also to be able to eliminate, because these create a lot of I don't have to say constipation. I hate to say that, but on the air, but it does.
Well, that's one of the side effects of opiates. It's not there for pot.
I'm sorry?
You said constipation. I said that's one of the side effects of the opiates. That's not a side effect of pot.
That's correct.
Right, right, and that puts more pressure on the pain problems if you have a back problem, say, and it helps you greatly because you can cut back opiates, which are not very desirable. Also, in California, I understand that there's a lot of issues legally right now with it, and I want to ask the doctor if he thinks that it's going to go more the way of Colorado, because heading back towards a ban in California?
Yeah. Okay, Tom, we have a little less than a minute before the break, so let's get the answer.
Sure. So, I will quickly say that he is absolutely right. In fact, the Journal of the American Medical Association published a study late last year, which said that there was a 25% reduction in overdose deaths in states that have reformed their marijuana policy and provided medical marijuana access, which saves, you know, approximately 300,000 lives a year.
Whoa.
Then I'll also say really quickly about California. I think that I know there is definitely going to be a ballot initiative in 2016 to legalize marijuana, and, you know, we are currently on the ground organizing and bringing all the stakeholders together.
Is somebody also doing a ballot initiative to recriminalize it?
No. So it's medical marijuana is established. We've got Prop 47, which defelonizes a lot of non-violent offenses, and now recreational marijuana ballot initiative 2016.
We'll be right back. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We are in the studio, Dr. Malik Burnett, MD, Policy Manager of the Office of National Affairs of the Drug Policy Alliance, drugpolicy.org. Back with more of your calls. Welcome back. Eric, watching Free Speech TV in Wichita, Kansas. Hey, Eric, you're on the air with Dr. Burnett.
Doctor, I've got a question for you.
Shoot.
What do we do? Living next to Colorado, and I watched a symposium out there of the pluses and minuses. Now they're growing higher concentration of marijuana. Can you guarantee people that this marijuana use does not damage DNA or change chromosomes? Or how about people under the age of 25, 26 using it? Does it alter the brain in any way? And what's long-term use? We know kids are getting it in Colorado. It's legal at 18, but they. What's your advice to small children?
Mm-hmm. So I think that everyone in the policy reform movement is very much on the of the opinion that, you know, marijuana use should be limited to those over the age of 21 outside of a medical capacity. As it relates to potency, this is another sort of red herring that, you know, people in the prohibition community like to throw around. Oh, this isn't your dad's marijuana. But when you actually think about potency, this is the increase in the effectiveness of a particular drug. And what you see in research is that once the potency is increased, people actually just use less marijuana.
Right. Well, and I can, drugs, I, you know, and as the old fart in the room here, I mean, I was smoking pot when I was 16 years old, which was 1967.
Okay.
And you could get pot, you know, like Acapulco Gold was $5 for a matchbox full.
Right.
And, you know, you had to smoke a whole joint to get high.
Right.
On the other hand, you could also get hash.
Right.
And one token,
right?
You know,
right.
So it's not like all of a sudden pot got strong, right. Or back in the '60s nobody had access to pot that could knock you on your butt,
right?
You know, we just you learn how to use it, like you're saying.
Exactly, exactly. And then the other thing that I wanted to talk about was the long term use. So right. Yet another myth that people put out there, or is a gross exaggeration of the facts. The whole, you know, discussion around losing IQ points for long-term marijuana use, when you actually read that study, it is the people who have the 8-point reduction in IQ was 8 people in a 200,000 people study who smoked pot continuously like 5 times a day for 20 years. So these are like users who are significantly outside the standard deviation of normal use,
right.
Or like 2 or 3 standard deviations.
So if you were doing this with alcohol, these would be the people who wake up in the morning with a pint of vodka and then have another pint for lunch and then a third before they go to bed.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know,
the outliers.
The whole notion around, you know, loss of IQ with marijuana use is a grossly over-exaggerated
fact.
What about
kids? His question about DNA. Alcohol actually can damage DNA.
Right. You know, there's not been any recorded scientific studies around use of marijuana altering your chromosomal DNA.
Yeah. So it really appears that this drug, outside of the legal peril,
right,
is safe.
It is safer, significantly safer than a lot of the common vices that people pursue. In
yeah.
The normal, normal
Certainly
space.
Tobacco and alcohol.
Certainly tobacco and alcohol.
Yeah. And maybe caffeine.
Hey.
Yeah, especially to people with blood pressure issues.
Right.
Okay. Does pot reduce blood pressure?
Well, so it has two different effects, right? So it widens your blood vessels, but at the same time increases your heart rate. So on blood pressure, probably tends towards increasing it, but not, you know, making it into a sort of problematic issue.
Yeah. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Dr. Malik Burnett, MD, in the office with us. He is the policy manager with the Office of National Drug Affairs, Drug Policy Alliance. Drugpolicy.org is the website. He also writes the Ask the Doc, or co-writes it, Ask the Doc column over on that website. Questions about medical marijuana or recreational marijuana or whatever it may be. Paula in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. Hey, Paula, you're on the air with Dr. Burnett.
Hi, Tom. You're the only person that would know that it's Sault Ste. Marie because you're a Michigander.
Yes, I've been there. My brother-in-law went to school there. So, yes.
Well, my comment is that as a retired public school teacher, I would like to recommend that the marijuana laws come in without changing the little cottage industries. All the little pot peddlers that I've known throughout my life that helped their income by just selling a bag here and a bag there. I'd like to maintain that. I don't want the corporations to have it.
Right. So that's an issue. Thank you, Paula, for the question. What can we do to keep this a craft industry?
So I think that this is a great point that Paula raised. This is largely a requirement and something that we continuously advocate for at Drug Policy Alliance is not to raise the barriers to entry too high. So, for example, in the Maryland legalization bill that I'll be talking about tomorrow, the licensing fee is $250,000 just to get the license, which,
yikes,
you know, makes it almost impossible for anybody who doesn't have a significant financial backer to be able to get into the industry. Largely,
yeah,
that's problematic.
For RGAR, that's chump change.
Exactly.
But
for, you know, the average person, that's pretty much impossible. So we, you know, advocate for not only limiting the barriers to entry, but also not being intentional about not excluding people who have criminal records.
Yeah.
You know, this is form of discrimination that is perpetuated throughout, you know, our economic environment. And as we're bringing on a new economic opportunity, we shouldn't be repeating those sorts of discrimination.
I absolutely agree. And in fact, people who might have a pot conviction might be the best people to work in the industry because they already know the product.
Right. They do have some experience.
Yeah, and I think that your framing this as a racial justice issue is so important.
Yeah.
We just, like, we're blowing through that conversation.
Right, right.
But anyway, back to our callers. Sharon in Arlington, Virginia. Hey, Sharon. You're on the air with Dr. Burnett.
Hi, Dr. Burnett.
Hi.
I'm sure you saw this, but there was a big story in the Washington Post February the 3rd
mm-hmm.
about Israel in particular and, you know, doing all the research that they do on medical marijuana. I suffer from chronic pain. I have a condition called interstitial cystitis, which mm-hmm. is chronic inflammation of the bladder, and there's really no cure for it, and you just try a lot of different kind of medication. So I read that article. I was very excited, and mm-hmm. They mentioned a company in Canada called Med Relief that's working with Israel, and this company in Canada they sell high concentrations of CBD.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, the bottom line is when I called them, of course, because I live in the United States, you know, they can't ship it to the U.S. You have to live in Canada. So, you know, what would you suggest to people who live, you know, who live in an area where they can't, they don't have access to this type of product? I mean,
you don't even have medical marijuana in Virginia, do you? I think not.
Yeah, no, it's really unfortunate for people who live in states where they don't have access to medical cannabis. You've seen lots of people around the country have to relocate themselves to places in order to gain access to it.
Yeah, the famous story is the Charlotte's Tears.
Exactly.
Or Webb. Or,
yeah, Charlotte's Webb. Yeah, Charlotte's Webb. And those parents are relocated, I believe, from Kansas, if I'm not mistaken.
I think it was New Jersey, actually. Because I think they were fleeing Chris Christie. That's how
fortunately, New Jersey has a small, budding medical marijuana program now, yeah. So they can get access there. But for people in states that don't have access, this is a real problem, and that's why, you know, we are trying to advocate for rolling back these prohibitionist laws all across the country.
Right. That's 2 minutes. Okay. Tim in Monterey, California. Quick question. We only have 2 minutes to go. We got a whole bunch of calls here. Real quick question, Tim.
Yes, absolutely, Tom. Dr. Burnett, my wife was in a car accident last year. She is suffering from sciatic pain and also numbness in her leg. Is there any chance that cannabis would assist her with that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's an opportunity there. It's certainly, if you're not getting relief from your typical opiate narcotics, you can try it. It's certainly anti-inflammatory, which is largely the basis for that sort of pain.
And according to the U.S. patent that the federal government has, it's also neuroprotective.
That is correct.
And sciatic, I mean, that's a sciatic nerve.
Neurological component.
Good one. Thank you, Tim, for the call. Let's see here. Mercury? Am I saying that right? In Albuquerque, New Mexico?
Mercury, yes.
Mercury.
That's me, Tom.
You're on the air.
Yes. Thank you so much. Dr. Burnett, I need help. I'm here in New Mexico, and there is a medical marijuana program, but we're really destitute. And my daughter is very, very sick. She has diabetes mellitus since almost 43 years. She has second renal failure. She is on dialysis. She recently had a brain stroke. She has where she is just so underweight.
Mercury, we're gonna run out of time here before the doctor has a chance to answer you.
Yeah, no, I'm really sorry that there's an incredibly unfortunate situation. In a lot of states, there is a palliative care option. This is certainly a place where you can find relief. I believe that they have conditions that your daughter should be able to apply for in New Mexico. Their medical marijuana program has conditions that you should be able to get some help for. So hopefully you can do that.
Good luck, Mercury. We're so sorry to hear the story, the situation with your daughter. I wish her and you the very best. And thank you all for being with us today. It's been a great day, great 3 hours. And thank you to Dr. Burnett, especially. Dr. Malik Burnett, a policy manager with the Office of National Affairs, Drug Policy Alliance, drugpolicy.org. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Really appreciate you dropping by. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you to participate. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.